Okay. All right. So welcome to the first panel today, Aging and Cancer, Live and Let Die, or a Cancer 3 Methuselah. Jeff always comes up with these interesting titles. So. Okay. And I'm joined with Judith Campisi, Professor Buck Institute for Research in Aging, and James DeGregori from University of Colorado Cancer Center. Okay. So I just want to set the stage real quickly and really hand it off to the panelists because, this is an area of, interesting biology, and, some of us may not really understand exactly what's going on with understanding, longevity, senescence, and the implications to cancer. But, it's clearly we all deal with and we hear about the challenges of managing patients with cancer. Not only cancer incidence rates rises with age, older adults are really challenged with bearing the brunt of dealing with cancer, and particularly over 50, I think about around 62 is the median age of incidence. It's correlated with one, just longevity, that we're living a lot longer, and as you age, you're accumulating mutations and the potential for, activating a pathway that's likely to lead to, aberrant growth and avoidance of apoptosis and cell death. But that's just one. It's a very simplified view of some of the things that are going on. There are obviously a lot other things that are going on in the cell, as well as the host that facilitates the evolution of cancer. And we're going to hear about some of the different theories and models around that. But also, besides being, having the highest incidence in older adults, they also the prognosis is very poor. One, because of patient or host specific things where you can't tolerate chemotherapy or potential for treatment or cures or go through bone marrow transplants, but also the molecular features and the cytogenetics of the tumor, tends to be more high risk features to it as well. So it's also more difficult to treat and manage the patients. Even the patient can tolerate the best, forms of therapy, whether it's, high dose chemotherapy, targeted agents, or even immuno-oncology. A lot of it has to do with, the patient's ability to tolerate the treatments, but also the refractoriness of the tumor itself. So not knowing too much about it, I do a lot of work in AML, and I hear all the story all the time about, patients can't tolerate the 7+3 that, is a potentially curative treatment, but, also that they have, much poor prognosis even if they can go through that. I looked at, what's the NCCN guidelines on it, and so there's, 200-page document talking about, different ways to deal with how to assess a geriatric patient, how to understand their performance status, how to understand things like cognitive function, what are disease specific recommendations for each tumor type, and a lot of the things deal with dose modifications based on comorbidities and managing the patients with the tools that we have right now, not really thinking about how you incorporate the understanding of the biology more, or how you think about how you deal with tumor specific changes that are associated with cancer in older patients. And so the guidelines are largely empiric, so like, well, what's a patient look like and how do I modify my treatment plan based on the way they present? And another thing that's challenging is that, I think yesterday we had some discussion about how many patients, cancer patients participate in clinical trials. I think somebody said 4 to 6%, and somebody else said it was a little bit higher than that. But that's of everybody, and typically older patients aren't participating in clinical trials either because they're just not willing, they're not getting referred to centers, they don't want to, or they have difficulties in being transported. But there's a whole lot of reasons that we don't have a lot of translational information for older adults compared to younger cohorts. So there's a big need to sort of drive a better understanding of the clinical situation in older adults. So that's it for me. So I just wanted to set the stage, and I wanted to, you know, hand it off to the panelists to talk about the different, theories and models of aging and cancer, and then we're going to talk about how biotech companies and academicians like Judy are translating this understanding of biology into, you know, potentially actionable therapies. So James, you want to start first?
Great. Thanks a lot, Mike, and thanks for the invitation to come and speak to you. So I'm going to be talking from a very 10,000-foot theoretical perspective, but before everyone starts pulling out their phones to check their emails, I should mention that I think this is, understanding sort of the ultimate causes of disease. And by ultimate, I mean instead of thinking about just the mutations or the actual proximate causes of cancer, for example, that we understand why do we get cancer late in life. And really what I'm talking about is sort of the evolutionary explanations. But I think this is really fundamental if we really want to be able to both prevent and treat the disease. And so we learned from, going way back over 40 years now, Peter Noel first came up with the idea, who actually just recently passed away, I think at about 90, so he lived quite a long time, is that cancer arises by clonal selection. And you could, this is the pointer. And so basically the idea is that cancer's limited by initiating mutations that then cause a clonal expansion, giving the cells some, advantage, and which will increase the probability of the next event. And I actually think that was one of the really fundamental insights. And it's really just simple math and probability. Because you can imagine that if it just required a sequential accumulation of mutations without those intervening clonal expansions, when you have mutation rates on the order of 10 to the minus 8th, it's just never going to happen. But by expanding out to larger populations, the chance of the next event becomes much more probable. But I think what this model has really ignored is that these mutations don't automatically confer fitness benefits. And that's because that's how, in evolutionary biology, we know that the fitness benefit of a mutation is entirely context dependent. Gills will do you good in the water, but they're not going to do you any good on land, to just give one simplistic explanation. And so we're going to be talking more about what is the context that might allow or not allow this mutation to be advantageous. And so the basic current paradigm for cancer is that there's a sequential accumulation of mutations, and that accounts for this sort of late-life exponential rise in cancer. So as Mike just mentioned, over 90% of cancers occur in the population that's over 50. So cancer is largely a disease of the elderly, not entirely. And the idea is that that's the sequential accumulation of mutations model, and that was seen recently, for example, in the paper from Bert Vogelstein's lab that basically came up with this bad luck idea for cancer. And this has led to a large number of papers, many of them very high impact, that have basically modeled cancer this way. And essentially, cancer risk is modeled and estimated based solely on the impact of these intrinsic factors on mutation causation. So it's all about the mutations. And I'm going to argue that it's not so simple. It's really way more complex than that. And that's not how evolution works. So this is sort of another way of looking at the current paradigm. You have the causes, aging, smoking, irradiation, whatever, right? And that they're causing mutations leading to malignant phenotypes. And while people will consider microenvironmental change, they're often thinking about it being actually caused by the malignant phenotype. In other words, the cancer itself is promoting this malignant phenotype. And so if you think about lung cancer, the aging and smoking, they're causing lung cancer because of the mutations. I should mention, we also, of course, know that smoking causes lung cancer, but about 15 to 20% of lung cancers are not caused by smoking. And probably the factor that most associates with them is just old age. So it's like many other cancers. It is even for lung cancers, a good chunk of lung cancers are actually just caused because of the fact that we get old. So what is missing from these models? As I just mentioned, the fitness impact of mutations are only realized in the context of environment. This is just classic evolutionary biology. I mean, we can even think about it with antibiotic resistance. A mutation that confers antibiotic resistance is actually selected against in the absence of antibiotics. It has a fitness basically disadvantage. But in the presence of antibiotics, it becomes hugely advantageous. Same mutation, two different contexts, completely opposing effects on the fitness value. Also, we know that stem cell parameters and tissue microenvironments change dramatically as we age. I've never ceases to amaze me how everyone tries to draw linear curves from what is not a linear process. And you actually just saw that in the example Mike showed of, it was on one of the slides, where mutations with age, where they drew a line connecting the mutations. But actually, that would actually, to me, be a very different curve if you actually modeled it correctly. Really, it's kind of underpowered to model it well, but it's probably not linear accumulation. There's actually lots of data that we don't accumulate mutations linearly with age. So why is there this focus on mutations as the drivers of cancer? And I think a large part of it is because of this idea that oncogenic events improve cellular fitness, and thus cancer is limited by their occurrence. If an oncogene is always giving an advantage to a cell, well, then it will be the limiting event, right? It's going to be the limiting factor that promotes it. So this idea that if you were to sort of graph out fitness, there's an increase in that fitness with the oncogenic event. But it's actually not true when you actually look under physiological context. True, we put an oncogene into cells in culture, particularly if they're already immortalized, and the cells love it and they expand out rapidly. But when people have made a number of different oncogenic events, everything from tumor suppressor losses to overexpression of oncogenes in, for example, hematopoietic stem cells in a mouse, and they do it under relatively unperturbed conditions. So I'm not talking about in the context for example, a bone marrow transplant, because that's not an unperturbed condition. That's going to be an unnatural condition. Then in almost every case, the effect on the hematopoietic stem cells is a loss of self-renewal. And what that will mean, if that event occurs in a single cell, it'll lead to the exhaustion of the clone. And actually, tumor suppression will win. That clone will end up being some granulocytes that end up with a, you know, few-hour half-life in your periphery, and tumor suppression won out in that case. So despite all these papers showing this, not one of these papers that I could find actually mentioned that this would be a really incredibly good tumor suppressive mechanism. Because we like to think of oncogenic events as being drivers of cancer, not that they're actually, in most cases, lead to the elimination of the cell. And in many ways, this should be obvious. I mean, we've known for decades that MYC induces apoptosis, that RAS induces senescence, and that often you need two events to overcome that problem. But again, if you go back to Peter Knowles' work, getting two events means at least one of those events must be adaptive and expand out, because otherwise your probability is going to be really low. So another factor is that the rate of mutation accumulation is actually maximal during ontogeny. So this is showing data from mice, from Jan Vige's lab, but it could be from many other different systems. And in some ways, it should be sort of obvious. I mean, it takes a lot more cell dividing to make a human or to make a mouse than it does to maintain a human or a mouse. Our hematopoietic stem cells are dividing quite frequently during ontogeny and up through birth and even somewhat afterwards. And then they slow down to dividing about once every year and a half afterwards. So it's going to be an amazing effect on the accumulation of mutations. And this is actually data from epigenetic changes from Steve Horvath. And you can see the rate of epigenetic changes is incredibly rapidly early in life, and then it slows down immensely later in life. So it's not like we don't continue to accumulate damage. We do, but that rate of accumulation is much lower after we reach adulthood because our cells are dividing much, much less. So that's going to be in contrast with this very late life cancer incidence. So we have to think about what is it, how are we accumulating changes early but not getting as many cancers? So other factors are that oncogenic mutations are actually prevalent in normal non-cancerous tissues. About a third of us in this room have BCR-ABL translocations in our blood right now. If you were to take any of our tissues, if you look sensitively enough, we're loaded with oncogenic mutations. Hell, you can just do simple math. We have trillions of cells, mutation rates about 10 to the minus 8th. Right now, you have every possible oncogenic mutation you could ever have in thousands of your cells, just from chance alone. Another factor is the evolution of complex multicellularity was not accompanied by reductions in mutation rates. So this may come as a surprise, but we're actually worse than yeast and bacteria at maintaining our DNA. And there's complex evolutionary reasons for that. But you would think that if avoiding cancer meant avoiding mutations, that evolution would have basically figured out some way to lower mutation rates. But it hasn't. In fact, if anything, they've gone up. So I'm not saying that oncogenic mutations aren't necessary for cancer. They are. But I'm saying they're not the time-limiting factor. They're not the factor we should be putting all of our focus on. So it's another problem that was pointed out by Richard Pitot many decades ago, and that's what's known as Pitot's paradox. How is it that you can have blue whales and mice, which vary by 10 to the 7th fold in cell number and 50-fold in lifespan, and yet the blue whale doesn't have a problem with cancer that appears any worse than what a mouse has with cancer? And if you look at things from the cell autonomous perspective of accumulating mutations, then this guy has a whale of a problem. I couldn't help that. Another factor is we could think about diseases like CML, which in the chronic phase is driven by a single mutation, and colon and pancreatic cancers, which are driven by 3 to 7 mutations, depending on who you talk to. So different number of events required, but the actual curve of incidence is strikingly similar. And so if this was limited by occurrence, then you would expect different kinetics of these diseases, but we don't get those. And this is my favorite example because it actually comes from Larry Loeb's lab. And Larry Loeb is really the father of this sort of the mutator idea that cancer basically requires a mutator phenotype. And he published that this DNA polymerase delta mutation, and one of the mutations basically increased because it takes away the proofreading function, increases mutation rates 5-fold, 17-fold for chromosomal aberrations. And yet there was no change in cancer incidence or lifespan. Now, if you thought of cancer as being limited by mutations, this doesn't fit, right? I mean, you've increased mutation rates substantially, and you didn't increase cancer rates, nor did you decrease lifespan. So instead of, you know, shouting from the mountaintops that he's overcome two major paradigms with this work, he instead focused on a second mutation that he made in the same mouse that actually shifted cancer earlier, but didn't increase the incidence, just made him come up a little earlier, and also shifted the decline in lifespan earlier. And so the paper was really focused on that and sort of still fell within the current paradigm, even though really, to me, it says that increased mutations is not sufficient for increased cancer. So then why do we get cancer and mostly at older ages? And indeed, why do we age at all? And I think this is really, I think, the most important figure I'm going to show you. And that's that this is actually a graph of humans, it's estimated, from Europeans, but about 15,000 years ago. Okay, and so you can see that basically there weren't a whole lot of people alive after 50. And in fact, actually, even those alive after 50, their chance of successfully reproducing was much, much lower. Because you can imagine, if you might be a woman at 50, but if you have a baby, but then you don't make it to 65 to see that child make it to be on its own, that the chance of survival for that child was much lower. So it's not even being alive isn't enough. It's being alive long enough to actually see your offspring make it on their own so that they can reproduce. And think about cancer and other diseases of aging. So this is actually sort of a rough cancer curve, but you can think about it as heart disease, neurological diseases, anything, right? It comes up later. But you'll notice there's not a whole lot of overlap between these curves. And so the reason we get these diseases late in life is simply that natural selection, the force of natural selection to prevent them, has waned. We are getting them because natural selection basically acts to maximize reproductive success, period. To really put it crassly, we're just vehicles for our gametes. And we're looking for the best strategy. Natural selection works on the best strategy to pass those gametes on to the next generation. And so you can imagine, well, why not? I mean, there is some overlap. So why didn't natural selection work to even limit cancer even further? And I think probably the major reason is because anything that is going to push cancer and aging off further to the right is going to come with some cost. And if that cost meant less efficient reproduction when you're young, well, then the cost of it would have been greater than the benefit, and it wouldn't have been acted on by natural selection or would have been selected against. And so the simple reality is that We basically, natural selection has tuned aging strategies to maximize reproductive success for current environmental conditions for that species. And so I think this is actually one of those sort of, you know, 10,000-foot type of view of things that's really ignored in medicine, but really it's the major reason we're getting most diseases late in life, at least the, you know, sort of the ultimate reason. So this is really how we can look at it. You can imagine if there's a new species in a new environment where it's not maximally fit, then evolution at the germline level is going to act to maximize the fitness of this organism. But it's only going to, the pressure is going to basically wane in the post-reproductive period. So that investment's going to go down afterwards because there was the likelihood of a return on that investment gets lower and lower. And oh, I should mention that this is not new theory. This goes back to George Williams, Peter Medawar. These are ideas that started back in the 1950s. So, and I love to show this curve because this really shows the inevitable decline. And a lot of my colleagues say this is a really depressing curve, but I'm going to show it anyway. I try to put, you know, like cute little cartoons at the bottom to make it a little less depressing. But these are basically marathon world single age records. And there's two things you should notice about this. One is that no matter how, this is the best of the best. And no matter how much we train, no matter how much we take care of our bodies, by we mean them, you're going to get worse. And your time and the best time in the marathon gets worse and worse as we get older. But the other thing you should notice about this is this flat period. So between about 18 to about 36, at any given time, anyone can hold that world record in that age group. In fact, many people have within that. So that's a pretty big span of period of life where it's pretty flat, where essentially, you know, there really isn't aging between 20 and 30. There's aging after 40, for sure. In fact, our decline gets more and more rapid. But the key thing about this is the highest odds of reproductive success. And it really shows you how you can see that investment in that we don't start declining immediately. We're not born and we start declining. We start declining about with the inverse probability of our chance of reproductive success. And, of course, this leads to well-known mortality curves. And again, you can see life is not linear. Your chances of dying don't change a whole lot over your first few decades of life, and then they rapidly accelerate. Now, of course, this is in a modern nation like the U.S. or U.K. where these odds are, you know, where we basically have pushed that mortality out more and more to the right. So this is largely limited by sort of our intrinsic makeup, our evolved makeup, and no longer limited by external hazards like tigers. So what does this investment in tissue maintenance during youth and the waning of this investment in old age have to do with cancer? And by the way, Mike, what time did I start? I didn't notice that, just so I keep track.
I don't know. You're good.
Okay. So what does this investment have to do with cancer? And this is where the theory that my lab has developed comes in. It's adaptive oncogenesis, and I've already gave you some highlights of it. But essentially, here's the key part of the theory. So what we argue is that in youth, that period where we have a reproductive probability, right, chances of reproductive success, that high stem cell fitness opposes somatic evolution and thus promotes the status quo. So just like in a population of animals, bacteria, rutabaga, whatever, that animals will evolve to be near the peak of some fitness curve where basically they've got the right amount of almost every trait. And this is because any animal that didn't have that right amount over time would be selected against, right? So we know that in evolutionary biology, populations tend to occupy peaks. And thus, change will be almost always disadvantageous because change will mean basically a change in a parameter that was already optimized. So what I'm arguing is that our stem cells, we've evolved stem cells to also be at peaks of fitness because this would inherently be tumor suppressive. Because stabilizing selection is going to kick in. And even though you can think that an oncogenic change might be a good thing for the cell, it's actually going to cause a change in a parameter that will cause loss or falling off of this peak. And the cells will be outcompeted by their peers. So even if there was this cancer peak over here that has a higher fitness, if getting there means going through low fitness intermediates, most of the time that clone is going to be lost. Not all the time, but most of the time. I mean, keep in mind, natural selection is not perfect. It's going to optimize, but not completely optimize any given trait or whatever. So that's what happens when we're young, and so that can explain why those same oncogenic mutations that are occurring, you know, half of them have occurred by the time you're 18, are not actually going to be positively selected. But, unfortunately, we get old. We get old, or we do things like we smoke, and so change the microenvironment. So while we think of smoking as causing the mutations that lead to lung cancer, the major effect of smoking, in my mind, is going to be that it changes the microenvironment, leading to selection of new types that are adaptive to that new microenvironment. And so we can see that here. Now, the same wild-type genotype occupies a different position on the peak. And this is going to lead to, basically, adaptive evolution. So now there's room for improvement. And so now, because the cell is not, you know, optimally fit in its environment, it's going to adapt to its new environment, just like it would, you know, if it was an animal in nature. And this can lead up a more malignant genotype. It won't always lead to it, but it can. It's going to increase those probabilities. And in addition, aging will increase the diversity of such mutations, so it will increase epigenetic and genetic diversity upon which selection can act. But I would argue that it's that the selection that's the key limiting factor that can then lead to these genetic, to this adaptive evolution. So what I'm arguing is that the causes, aging, smoking, radiation, are largely affecting microenvironmental changes, leading selection for adaptive mutations. And I contrast this with this other, more conventional way of looking at things, but I do want to point out, they're not mutually exclusive. So, for example, if one smokes, there is a contribution of increased mutations. That's going to increase the probabilities. It's just what I'm arguing, that without changing the microenvironment, that those new mutations would have very little effect. Just like that mouse that had tenfold more mutations didn't get more cancer. More mutations isn't sufficient. You need to change the microenvironment. So I just want to mention that we've done computational modeling to back this up. And don't worry, I'm not going to show you any of the computational modeling, just going to give you the results of it. But if anyone likes computational modeling, it's published. So it's a Monte Carlo model. And basically, this just sort of shows you a schematic of the model that runs in sort of this Monte Carlo environment. Again, I'm not going to go into it. But the important thing that we did here is, unlike very many previous models, we incorporated in real data. So we actually incorporated how the hematopoietic stem cell pool changes with age, how cell cycle rate changes with age, and we used this to derive formulas that could tell us the fitness, the effect of mutations on fitness, and how that might change with age. And the first thing that this model showed us is that mutations are insufficient both to explain stem cell functional decline with age and to account for the clonal expansion of these stem cells acquiring driver mutations. So we couldn't get the model to work with mutations alone. But the more importantly, what it showed was that these late life incidences in leukemia risk, because we're modeling this in the hematopoietic system, are likely dependent on age-dependent microenvironmental change, which alters the fitness impact of mutations. Basically, it was only if you allowed for the microenvironment to basically change the fitness values of mutations could we get late life leukemia in the model. And we also do mouse modeling. I should mention we do human too, but I'm not going to have time to get into that. And so Curtis in my lab used mouse models to explore changing how tissue adaptive landscapes change with age. And again, just to sort of summarize 5 years of Curtis's life in one quick slide, what he showed was that aging-associated inflammation promotes selection for adaptive oncogenic events in B-cell progenitors. So in the young, healthy bone marrow, he showed that he could introduce an oncogenic mutations, but basically they didn't clonally expand. They were eliminated. But in old bone marrow, that same mutation would be acted on by positive selection. He could show even why it was adaptive. It corrected some of the deficits that were present in those stem cells in the bone marrow in the old, leading to clonal expansion. But if he blocked inflammation, he could pretty much prevent that from happening. And that says that we could change an extrinsic parameter and change the dynamics of cancer. And I think that's going to be a critical thing. And you're going to hear more about this from Judy in just a minute, because she's basically got a way to do it. So this is the overall model. And that's that leukemia incidence is shaped by the changing age-dependent balance of drift, stabilizing selection, and positive selection. I didn't go into it, but we've actually published an explanation for childhood leukemias, and it's actually there's a contribution of drift there. But the most important thing I've told you about is that despite the fact that we're accumulating damage much earlier in life, and this is real data from Horvath, that stabilizing selection is acting on it, basically keeping those mutations from being advantageous. So it's favoring the status quo, which is what we want for most of our life. But late in life, when natural selection no longer gives a crap about us, our tissues start getting more damaged, they get more inflammatory, and this leads to positive selection for types, phenotypes, that are adaptive on this new landscape. So what are the implications? First off, the maintenance of tissue landscapes by good diet, exercise, not smoking should limit adaptive oncogenesis. And you're like, well, yeah, we already knew those things prevented cancer. But yeah, but I've given you a different reason for why they prevent cancer. I think that understanding the risk of cancer will require an appreciation for how different factors impact context-dependent selection of mutations, not just their occurrence. So if we think about what makes a carcinogen, you can't just look for oncogenic or the causation of mutations. I think, more importantly, I think when we think about therapies, chemotherapies achieve a short-term goal, reduce tumor burden, but they can often come up short in long-term patient survival and well-being. And I think we might want to think about a Marshall Plan post-therapy, and I think Judy has such a Marshall Plan, that even preventative mechanisms that promote basically a stable tissue regime. In other words, we can go in and bomb the hell out of the cancer, but if we don't come up with a way to make for a more stable environment that disfavors cancer phenotypes, we're going to end up losing the battle. And I think immune therapy is actually a part of this, because immune therapies are kind of like the drones. As opposed to just raising the country, you can hopefully go in there and be a little bit more surgical with what you're trying to do. So we should be able to modulate the fitness effects of cancer-associated mutations by manipulating the environment, which I showed you with inflammation. And finally, I think this tells us that while aging, I think, is inevitable, it's still modulatable. And so that's just to thank the people that did work. I should mention that the artwork was all done by my son. I am not the artist. But Charles Zanarella gave us this anti-IL-37 mouse, and I already showed you pictures of the people that did the work earlier. And I think we're going to end up taking questions at the end, and we'll go straight to Judy. Is that right, Mike?
Yeah.
Great. Thank you.
So, again, thank you for the invitation, Jeff and Mike. This is an unusual audience for me. I usually talk to either basic scientists or pure clinicians, and you guys are somewhere in between, so this will be a challenge. The problem is I'm short, and so I'm going to have that. So I'm going to talk a little bit about translational potential for applying what you just heard from James to the clinic, but I do want to emphasize it's still very much at the potential stage. And I will start with a disclaimer. I am a scientific founder of this company, Unity Biotechnology. They're mostly working on degenerative diseases of aging, and you'll see why I think that's important. We're very interested in cancer, and this is still virgin territory for us. So I'm not going to talk about any of Unity's goals. So we'll start with aging. You heard from James that fitness declines with age, and this is the reason why. So nobody dies of good health. We die of disease. And this is, of course, a partial list of the many diseases of aging. And if you look at these diseases, it's pretty remarkable. They're very different manifestations, very different cell types. For example, in the brain, it's mostly neurons that die. If you think about heart disease or vascular disease, it's mostly cell communication that breaks down, but again, very different types of cells. And yet, of course, what all these diseases have in common is they're exceedingly rare in young people, and somewhere around the midpoint of our lifespan, so 50 to 60 years of age for us, all of these diseases rise with exponential kinetics. So you can imagine two possibilities. One is this is just an amazing coincidence. Those of us who work on aging don't believe that. We really think that it's not a coincidence, that there are basic aging processes. There's something about aging per se that's driving all of these diseases, including this disease, cancer, which is a little bit different from the other diseases in that it's not so much degenerative, but it's hyperplastic. So we think we have identified one such process. And I'm going to tell you about it and tell you what we can and cannot do to counteract that process. And that process is a cellular stress response, which has been termed cellular senescence. We think it's a candidate basic aging process. I don't want to leave you with the impression that we think it's the only thing that's driving aging, but we think it's an important one and also an important driver of many of the diseases, including cancer. And I'll show you some data to support that. So we now think of cellular senescence as a stress response to perturbations that primarily put cells at risk for neoplastic transformation. So it is in many ways an evolutionary balancing act, and I'll show you exactly what I mean by that in a moment. But this stress response, what's important to understand about it, is it has two parts. It has a bipartite phenotype. So one is, in response to a stress, cells stop dividing, essentially irreversibly. This, of course, becomes extremely important for preventing cancer because a cell that can't divide cannot go on to form a tumor. But coupled to this growth arrest is the fact that the cells also begin to secrete molecules that very much change the tissue microenvironment. And I'll show you three examples of how a senescent cell can change the environment of the tissue, so acting on non-senescent neighboring cells within a tissue. And so this is why we think this is a balancing act. The growth arrest is undoubtedly tumor suppressive. That's been shown in mouse models. There are some humans with mutations in genes that cause cells to undergo senescence. Those mice and those humans all die in early death due to cancer. So we know that this is suppressive for the development of cancer. But now we also have new data that suggests that this secretory phenotype is also important for tissue repair and for healing of wounds. I'll show you an example in the skin. So these are good things to have. And we believe that they act optimally in younger organisms to do just that, prevent cancer and promote wound healing. The problem is senescent cells tend to be very stable. They tend not to die. And as a consequence, they accumulate with age. I'll show you data to suggest that. And so late in life, we believe those very same cells can promote those phenotypes and those diseases that we associate with aging. So this is what I mean by an evolutionary balancing act. So there's the good news and the bad news. And the challenge for us is how to preserve the good and try to mitigate the bad. So let me start by giving you in a few slides, 20 years worth of work from dozens and dozens of laboratories that have studied this process of senescence and have tried to answer this question, when and where do we find senescent cells? So the first place is we find them. Let me start by saying markers, biomarkers of senescence. So the good news is we now have dozens of markers that allow us to go in with some confidence and say a cell that expresses some subset of markers is probably senescent. The bad news is none of these are specific. There really is no such thing as a senescence-specific marker. And so what we're left with is really a conglomerate of phenotypes that we then can say with some confidence we can assign that cell to be senescent. I want to emphasize two important markers. One is this protein called P16. This is a tumor suppressive protein. It's a cell cycle inhibitor. It's largely responsible for causing the growth arrest. And I'll show you why in a moment we think this is an important biomarker because we've used it to create mouse models to modulate senescent responses. And the second is something I alluded to earlier, which is that these cells are stable. They tend to resist cell death, and we have some ideas about why that's the case. Because of that, we think this is why they accumulate with age. So to my knowledge, every vertebrate species from humans to zebrafish that have been examined have shown an age-dependent increase in the number of senescent cells in multiple tissues, actually virtually every tissue that has been examined. This is human skin, and this shows one of these biomarkers. It's a beta-galactosidase that allows us to detect the cells by X-gal staining, so the cells turn blue. And you can see they're very rare in young skin and in old skin. This is actually sun-damaged skin, so it's not even driven so much by the damage. This is really an age-dependent process. We see it in both the dermis and the epidermis as people increase with age. And the other place that these cells are observed is at sites of age-related pathology where there are more of them compared to age-matched control. And I'm showing you two examples. This is an example of a COPD, chronic obstructive pulmonary disorder, the major cause of lung failure in the elderly. And this is in the pulmonary artery. These are smooth muscle cells staining for this P16 protein, which is a marker of senescence. And compared to age-matched controls, there's an increased number. And this has been shown now for many, many pathologies. Atherosclerosis, osteoarthritic joints, and in this case, Alzheimer's, brains, where compared to age-matched controls, there are more senescent cells in the Alzheimer's, in the diseased brain. But in this case, I just want to emphasize the cells that become senescent are the astrocytes, which, as you all know, are the origins of glioblastoma, the origins of brain cancer. So it's not the neurons that express these markers. It's the cells that are at risk for developing cancer. So you can say that senescent cells now are a smoking gun. They're present at the right time and the right place to qualify for being a process that's driving multiple age-related pathologies. There are two important questions, though. One is, how could they do it? Why would these cells be driving such disparate pathologies from neurodegeneration to cancer? And the other question, of course, is do they do it? Because right now, everything I've told you is correlation. But I'll show you that at least now in a mouse, I think we can say the answer to this is yes, they do. So let me start with how we think these cells might be driving very disparate pathologies. And the key has to do with the secretory phenotype. We've studied the molecular biology of the secretory phenotype, and we understand its molecular control, and we can say that there are two main branches based on that molecular control. One is this gamish of 40 or 50 different cytokines, chemokines, growth factors, and proteases. We call it the senescence-associated secretory phenotype. This phenotype is completely independent of P53. There's another secretion, a class of secreted factors, which is typified by this protein HMGB1, but is now a member of a large growing population of molecules that are called DAMPs, damage-associated molecular patterns, things that cells secrete when they're damaged. This is P53-dependent, and again, senescent cells secrete many of these molecules. What both of these secretory phenotypes have in common is they have the ability to drive inflammation. And as James pointed out in his talk, really inflammation is the key to understanding the quality of a tissue microenvironment for its ability to support tumor growth. So let me show you a few examples that argue that the secretory phenotype of senescent cells is indeed causal in changing a tissue microenvironment in a way that will promote cancer phenotypes, as well as degenerative diseases of aging. So again, both types. So the first is an example of normal tissue structure and function. So what you're looking at is a three-dimensional culture of mouse breast epithelial cells. What happens is these cells are seeded as single cells in a 3D matrix. They grow a little bit. They self-organize into alveoli. That's what you're looking at here. And these cells produce milk. So we give them lactogenic hormones. They turn on beta casein, in this case, is what the red staining is. And you can see if we embed in these cultures non-senescent cells, we still get beautiful alveoli, lots of milk. If the cells are senescent, now those alveoli fail to organize properly, and milk production falls. So loss of normal tissue structure and function. We now know the molecules that are responsible for this transition, and it's mostly the proteases that the senescent cells secrete. Now, the second example has to do with normal stem cell functions. So these are human neural stem cells, and the green is incorporation of BRDU into DNA, so a measure of DNA synthesis or cell proliferation. And if we take conditioned medium from astrocytes now and put it on these neural stem cells, you can see that if the astrocytes are senescent, there's something that is suppressing the ability of those normal stem cells to proliferate. We don't know what that factor is. And the third example I'll show you is has to do with cancer. So this is tumor volume over time of a pre-malignant cancer cell that was injected into the mammary gland of a mouse. So these are pre-malignant cells. They don't form tumors. But if we co-inject them with senescent stromal cells, these cells will convert to full-blown malignancy. And if we inject human breast cancer cells into an immunocompromised mouse, we can show that the co-injection with senescent cells causes bigger tumors, also much better vascularized tumors. Senescent cells produce a lot of VEGF. So the idea is that over time, we accumulate senescent cells, and these cells, because of the secretory phenotype, begin to affect neighboring cells and cause tissue degeneration. But you heard from James that what really happens with age is we're also accumulating these pre-malignant cells. We all have them. And so we would argue that the presence of senescent cells likewise would drive the conversion of these cells into malignancy and cause then both the degenerative diseases of aging and the hyperplastic diseases of aging. Of course, cancer is the most deadly. So this is pretty depressing. If you don't have a senescence response, you die of cancer. And if you do have a senescence response, you're still going to die either of cancer or some degeneration. So what do we do about this? So we have envisioned two ways to tackle this problem. And the first is to try to stop the secretion. And I'm not going to talk much about that because although we've been successful, we don't think this is the optimal way to go about doing things. So if we want to suppress the secretory phenotype, we need to understand the pathways that drive that phenotype. We've done that. Here are three pathways that we've identified that are critical for driving the secretory phenotype. And the good news is that all of these pathways have targets. And many of those targets already have drugs that people like your companies have developed, mostly as anti-cancer drugs, and they're very effective at silencing those targets. So, for example, the DNA damage response pathway, we've shown that ATM and CHIK2 are critical regulators, especially of the inflammatory arm of the secretory phenotype. There are drugs in the clinic that kill ATM and kill CHIK2. They're very good at killing the secretory phenotype. The problem is all of these pathways are really important for normal tissue homeostasis. This would not be a viable option for taking a drug, say, to extend longevity or to prevent age-related diseases. So this is the big problem, is that these are very important pathways for normal tissue homeostasis. The other problem is as soon as you remove the drug, the cells are still there. And so they begin to secrete again. And I know drug companies hate to hear this, but there's no such thing as a perfectly safe drug. So if you have to take a drug constant, if you have to have constant pressure from a drug, we think this is not a good formula for extending longevity. So the idea then would be to take another approach, which is what if we can get these cells to die? And so this is what we've done. Is we've first done it in a mouse model, but I'll show you there are maybe some prototype drugs out there in the clinic that can maybe do what our mouse models can do. So the mouse model takes advantage of that tumor suppressor protein, P16. It's a pretty good marker for senescent cells, and what we've done is we've made a transgene in which the promoter for P16 is driving an artificial fusion protein. The fusion protein consists of a luciferase that allows us to image senescent cells in a living animal, red fluorescent protein that allows us to sort those cells from tissues, and then this viral protein, HSV thymidine kinase, which converts the prodrug ganciclovir into a toxic DNA chain terminator. Now, senescent cells don't divide, so they don't undergo nuclear DNA synthesis, but they do synthesize mitochondrial DNA. And we're able to show that this phosphorylated derivative gets into the mitochondria and causes the cells to die by apoptosis. So we've used this mouse model. And I should also say our colleagues at the Mayo Clinic have a similar mouse model. And these mouse models are now being used to interrogate the role of senescent cells in multiple age-related diseases. And I've listed some of them here. So everything in blue is published. Everything in black is still underway in our labs or our collaborators' labs. But what I'm going to talk about right now is this idea of chemotherapy being a driver of aging. And this was really inspired by papers, more and more papers that are coming out, like this one, which are following children who, I want to emphasize, their cancer was cured by conventional genotoxic chemotherapies, but we know those chemotherapies cause senescence in normal cells in vivo. And so we wondered whether some of the side effects of chemotherapy might be driven by the presence of senescent cells after the chemotherapy. And this is work that is done primarily now by Marco Di Maria, who now has his own lab at Arriba in the Netherlands. And what he did was he took our mouse model and he injected them with a single dose of different chemotherapeutic agents here. And then he waited. In this case, this is 3 months after the chemotherapy, but he's waited as long as a year. And that single dose of chemotherapy imposed, basically, we think, a lifelong burden of senescent cells above and beyond what you would see in a control animal. And that's shown here. These are now normal cells that are being driven into senescence by the chemotherapeutic agent, and these cells persist after the chemotherapy. So now we can ask, what is the cost of that chemotherapy or even radiation? We've also done this with ionizing radiation. So what we can do is we treat the cells with chemotherapy. In this case, this is doxorubicin or radiation. We wait a few months, and then we treat the animals with ganciclovir to eliminate senescent cells. And you can see that the ganciclovir reduces the luminescence and a bunch of markers that we identify with senescent cells. So now we can ask, what's the cost of having that burden of senescent cells? And the first cost we asked about was cancer metastasis. So in this case, we're using a breast cancer cell line that we inject into the mammary fat pad, the inguinal fat pad. And these cells are now labeled with a different luciferase. So now we're going to use a different luciferase to follow tumor growth in the animals. And so here's the result. Here's the primary tumor growing in the mammary gland. This is a metastasis to the liver, and this is a metastasis to the lung. Most of the animals develop these metastases. But if we cleared senescent cells, so we treat the animals with chemotherapy, and that has variable effects in reducing the tumor burden, the primary tumor burden. But now we ask, what is the cost of having this collateral damage on the normal cells with regard to metastasis, and in this case, we completely prevent the ability of those cells to metastasize. So our hypothesis is it's the normal tissue microenvironment that has been altered by the presence of senescent cells that is now conducive for the selective advantage of metastatic cells to produce a tumor. Now, the second problem with chemotherapy, many, especially the anthracycline chemotherapies, as you know, is cardiotoxicity. This is often what limits the amount of chemotherapy you can give patients. And we can model this in a mouse by doing echocardiography in the mouse. And so we've done this. This is a collaboration with our colleague Simon Mellup at the Buck Lab. And what we've done is we've now given the animals doxorubicin, and then we wait about 3 weeks, and we can show that there's a decline in ejection fraction, in ejection fraction and fractional shortening. So the heart is not pumping as well as it should. If immediately after the chemo, 3 days after the chemo, we clear senescent cells, we can prevent the ability of that loss of cardiac function to occur 3 weeks later. And the last example I'll show you is something that is, I think clinicians don't really care too much about this, but patients really do. It's this phenomenon called chemo fatigue. As you know, when patients get chemotherapy, they feel terrible for a few weeks after the chemo. And we can model this in a mouse by putting the animals after the chemotherapy into a metabolic cage. We can measure all sorts of parameters in these cages. The most important is activity. There's a running wheel. Normal mice will run. These are all done at night because mice are nocturnal. Will run kilometers on a running wheel if you give them the opportunity. And you can see what happens when they receive chemo. So these are non-treated mice. They spend 35 to 40% of their time on the running wheel. And if we give them chemotherapy, that drops to less than 10%. But if a few days after the chemotherapy we clear those cells, these animals now are as active as the non-treated animals. And so the idea is that we can perhaps mitigate some of the side effects of our favorite chemotherapeutic drugs by following with a so-called senolytic drug, a drug that could kill senescent cells. Now, do we have such drugs? The short answer is no, but the longer answer is we have prototypes, and these are two examples. This is a collaboration between our lab and Daohong Zhou's lab at the University of Arkansas, and this is an independent study by Valerie Krzyzanowski. These are AbbVie drugs. They were developed as anti-cancer drugs, and their primary target are the anti-apoptotic proteins, which are always at slightly higher levels in senescent cells. And so the idea is just to tip these cells into the balance of becoming apoptotic and then allowing them to die. Now, these drugs have side effects. The major side effect is thrombocytopenia. So there are now an army of chemists that are working to modify these drugs to make them safer. But the idea, this does show that there may be pharmacological approaches that can mimic what we can do with our transgene. So I just want to end coming back to James's point. Is there a cost to eliminating these cells? Because if you think about tumor suppression, there are two cell fates that are critical for suppressing tumor genesis. So one is cell senescence, which I told you about, but the other is apoptosis. And apoptosis is great. No inflammation, no muss, no fuss. So why did this second tumor suppressor mechanism evolve? And we think it evolved because the secretory phenotype also functions in younger organisms to promote wound healing. And this is shown again. This is now our transgenic mouse model. And it's a little complicated slide, but here are our 3MR mice in which we've inflicted a small biopsy on the dorsal flank of the animals. And now we're looking at wound healing. So this is what happens in those mice. Wound healing, these are male mice. They heal their wounds in 10 to 12 days. If we now treat the animals with ganciclovir, so these are senescent-free wounds, so Marco was able to show senescent cells appear at the site of the wound. If we prevent that from happening, wound healing is retarded. And these wounds are actually more fibrotic than these wounds, so it also, the presence of senescent cells also retards scarring. But what Marco was also able to do was sort those senescent cells from those wounds and ask, what are they making that could promote wound healing? And he was able to identify a single factor, and that's this growth factor, PDGFA. So now if he applies PDGFA topically to these senescence-free wounds, he can completely ablate that slow wound healing phenotype. So the idea is this is a balancing act. This is an evolutionary balancing act, and basically what we need to do is find ways to eliminate senescent cells from aged animals as well as chemotherapeutically treated animals and patients, but then also to be able to identify those factors that we think are positive so we can replace those factors and retain the good side of the good side of senescence. And so I'll just end. I've mentioned some of the people whose work this is. This is an ongoing project that's been going on for a dozen years or so, and it would not have been possible without a great group of collaborators. So thank you for your patience.
Thank you, Judy. Daryl, can you put up the last slide of my set? It has some key discussion points. But so while Daryl's doing that, anybody have a quick question from the audience? Any thing you want to ask either James or Judy? No? Okay. So, you know,
everyone's too depressed.
Yeah. And I said I wouldn't depress you with the first
question
panel.
Over there.
Is there a question over here?
James, AJ.
It is.
It's on.
Okay.
Two questions are directed towards you. One, when you were talking about the lung cancer, and I believe that you made a comment that there was only about 15% of lung cancer, or the converse was that roughly 80-85% of lung cancer was attributed to smoking.
That's correct, yeah.
Okay, I just wanted to get the converse of what you were stating. The second thing that you talked about was all the aspect of reproductive activity. You know, one of the things you didn't talk about is one of the areas of emphasis to enhance the microenvironment is stimulating our activity and the reproductive activity. Would that extend, you know, the curve outward?
So you're saying having more sex would keep us from aging?
Well, that's what I was... You know, we didn't talk about... Yeah. We talked about the reproductive function
right.
in terms of the healthy benefits
right.
of that. We didn't talk about doing anything to, you know, improve that aspect
yeah.
or improve that activity as a way of shifting the curve.
So, of course, these curves, I mean, these are sort of life histories. And so these are modulated over evolutionary time. You know, so this is many, many, many generations. And so it wouldn't, you know, even like I always get asked the question, well, now that we're reproducing later, would that, you know, have an effect? And the first thing I have to point out is, well, yeah, by we, you mean people you know, but most of the world is not reproducing later. So that's not going to be actually a strategy. So there are examples where changes in predation, by basically increasing your odds of reproducing later, by you meaning some animal, do actually extend lifespan. But of course, this takes many, many generations because now sort of that slower aging strategy pays off because now the animal had a reasonable shot of reproducing when before it would likely be eaten. So I think these can happen, but over evolutionary times. I think that, you know, in terms of like what can we do, I mean, I think in some ways, you know, a lot of these pathways that, you know, like that Judy even talked about, they can be modulated, like the, you know, mTOR pathway. Everyone's looking for sort of mTOR modulators because it's been shown that dampening mTOR can extend lifespan. But we already know that you can do the same thing by being about the right weight and exercising. And so I would argue that evolution's been very good at tuning. And evolution can tune the mTOR pathway to, you know, pick the life history that it wants to tune. But I don't think we're that good at tuning yet. So, like, I'm not going to be taking, you know, rapamycin because rapamycin also inhibits good things, like your immune system.
And what may be good... testicular function.
Yes. So the first thing I point out is you get a testicular atrophy from taking it, and immediately people go, like, step back, right? But so I think we have to think about those things. And so simple sort of prescriptions, I don't think are we're not there yet.
So I just fact-checked on my phone while you were talking. So, you know, we do have some examples of people living beyond 120 years old. Gene Kalman.
One.
The 122,
right?
Yeah. but we do have, you know, other super centenarians that have been, verified and everything. So, you know, can we, you know, envision a world where – everybody can live to, you know, 120, cancer-free, through any of the interventions that we had discussed?
Do you want to field that one first?
I don't think Jean-Marie Camon was cancer-free. She had cancer, but she didn't die of it. Uh-huh. So, I mean, I when I talk to pathologists, they tell me you do autopsies on very old people, and they often have these indolent occult cancers. So I'm not sure we can have a cancer-free lifetime. And the other thing I will point out is our colleagues at the Mayo have done the experiment of taking middle-aged mice and eliminating senescent cells from middle age to the end of life. And what they found is that cancer incidence did not change. The growth of those cancer cells, though, was slower, and the animals really did not show an increase in maximum lifespan, but they showed a big increase in health span. So they lived healthier longer, but in the end, they pretty much died on schedule. Yeah.
I think the goal would be to sort of square out the curve. So right now we have a curve where, you know, even, you know, your chance of dying is even greater at 50 or 60 than it was at 30 or 40. And if we could just sort of start pushing that curve up. So, yeah, we're all going to die eventually, but, you know, we'll have fewer people dying at 40, fewer people dying at 50 and 60, and more of us dying at 90 and 100 and maybe even 120. But I agree with Judy. We're not going to – I don't think we're going to ever prevent cancer. And I don't think we're ever going to prevent, you know, our eventual demise. The hope is that we just delay it for as long as possible.
Mm-hmm. So you guys know who Thurgood Marshall is?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So he has a wonderful quote. Somebody asked him how long he plans to live. You know, first black Supreme Court justice at a time when we were even less racially enlightened than we are now. And his response was, "I plan to die at 110 from a bullet wound from a jealous husband."
Going back to Jim's question. So aging is inevitable, but there are you mentioned that it's modifiable.
Right.
So
yeah.
You know, what are the key things to modify that you know, can mitigate our risk of cancer?
Well, senescent cells.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's a key one. I mean, I think that I actually think autophagy is going to be really important for this. I think there's a lot of genetic evidence for that we can modulate it. It's interesting. They actually made a mouse where they upregulated autophagy, and the mouse lived longer and had fewer problems. And it's not clear there was necessarily a cost to that, where there is a cost, I think, when you manipulate upstream with the mTOR pathway. But the interesting cost was it would be a huge evolutionary cost in the wild because the mice ate more to maintain the same weight. Now, that's a cost if you're in the wild and food is scarce, but for us, that would be like, yes. You know, so in some ways, because we're no longer sort of in the same evolutionary conditions, I think that to me is one of the possibilities. But again, I think we have to be careful with autophagy. I think we have to tune it. I don't think we can just come in with a sledgehammer. And that's going to be hard pharmacologically. Mm-hmm. Do you have anything to add to that?
I agree.
There's a question over there.
Oh, do we have a question?
Yeah.
So I'm wondering about the order of magnitude about all of these different effects. So we hear about caloric restriction increases the ability to life expectancy. Mm-hmm. Sugar now, there's a book out on sugar, which is extraordinarily sugar's pro-inflammatory. Glucose, people take metformin as a way of preventing aging because it reduces glucose in the blood. So I'm wondering, obviously, all of these strategies together would be beneficial, potentially very healthy strategies. Could you rank... And to try to find an order of magnitude of the senescence versus all of these lifestyle things that we can do, I'm not sure there's anything we can do about the senescence other than having all these other lifestyles, but could you kind of rank, I mean, if exercise or caloric restriction, metformin, twice-a-day aspirin, 81 milligrams to reduce inflammation, where should we emphasize? What is the relative ranking of all of these different approaches in terms of the ability to lead healthy, long-lasting lives and be active? Is it possible to even quantify the benefits of these different approaches? That's really what I'm asking.
Do you want to start off with that one?
I think the data that we're seeing now coming out of human studies and backed up by lots of mouse studies is probably the most important thing you can do is moderate exercise. So, I mean, there's been a study of obese, morbidly obese people that exercise or do not exercise, and there's an 8 to 10 year difference in lifespan. Just by, so you can still be mm-hmm. obese, still be diabetic, but as long as you exercise. And we have unpublished data. We're collaborating with a muscle biologist at McMaster's University, showing that if you take serum from athletes versus sedentary people and put them on naive human cells, the secretory phenotype of those naive human cells is suppressed by something in the serum of athletes, but not sedentary people. So, I think exercise would probably be number one. Caloric restriction is very difficult. It has to be caloric restriction without malnutrition, which is not so easy to come by. And there's been a mouse study of looking at, you know, dozens of genotypes, mouse genotypes. And caloric restriction did extend the lifespan of about a third of those animals. About another third, it had no effect. And another third, it actually caused them to die early. So, you know, caloric restriction is going to be very tricky, I think, to get it right. And you know, there is a caloric restriction society, right? If you go to the, I've talked at one of those meetings, it's so depressing. For lunch, they first pull out their scales, then they pull out all their pills because they have to eat this much and they have to keep their nutrition up. And so, I think they, I think, you know, it doesn't extend lifespan. It just seems longer.
Right? Yeah. Even if life's longer, it's probably miserable. But it reduces libido. It has a lot of negative effects. And so, and even immune function. So,
yeah.
But I agree completely. Exercise, and the cool thing about exercise is actually it's been molecularly tied into all these pathways we've talked about. Exercise decreases inflammation. It increases autophagy. And so it actually is actually doing probably in a more sort of tuned manner what we would hope to be able to do otherwise. And, you know, so I'm a big believer in that. And I don't know, has exercise decreased? Have you looked in senescent, your senescent
model? So we're doing that now. Yeah. We're doing that now.
Yeah. I'm willing to bet anything it will.
Me too.
So I have a question. So clearly over the 2 days, immuno-oncology has a great role to play in the industry and in the clinic right now. What are the studies showing the effects of immune modulating agents, whether checkpoint agents or other, on senescent cells, for example, or their secretory phenotype, et cetera? Because one thing that was striking me is with some of these agents, particularly IO agents, you see a disconnect between the response of the tumor and the actual outcome. So in other words, the tumor may shrink, but it's still there. But you're clearly improving durable remission, even lifespan, well, not lifespan, but in a small percentage of those patients. So in other words, is there something that the tumor is secreting or that those support cells are secreting, such as senescent cells, that actually lead to that additional morbidity or mortality? And does the immune system have an effect on that when you give these checkpoint inhibitors, for example?
Yeah, that's a tough one. I mean, you know, it's the checkpoint inhibitors, by clearing out a lot of the tumor, I definitely think, I mean, obviously a tumor itself, just the growth of the tumor is causing a lot of the negative effects on the patient. Everything from cachexia to probably leading to more inflammation and, you know, just tissue damage unto itself. But I think, you know, you mentioned that you could shrink a tumor and not necessarily eliminate, and the patient does a lot better. And I think we do need to start considering strategies that where the goal not isn't necessarily to completely eliminate the cancer, but to sort of live with it. And, you know, in some ways it's kind of like integrated pest management. You know, the old school way of doing it in agriculture was you went in, you just tried to eliminate the pest. And needless to say, you always came back with resistance. You hit something hard enough, and particularly with large population size, it's going to find a way around it. And a different strategy is sort of to not treat so much. And Bob Gattenby's been doing a lot of this. And it's really a beautiful strategy in that you're basically don't select for the resistance. At the same time that you're actually, the patient is going to feel better, be getting less chemo drug, so they'll also get less of the side effects, and it actually extends lifespan. By patient, I mean at this point mice, but there are clinical trials going on.
Can you speak at all to acute leukemia? Because that seems to be maybe an outlier to your theory, or maybe not. You alluded to drift, but
right.
Acute leukemia seems to spike in younger children relative to incidence right. In older. There might be some genetic implications.
Acute lymphocytic leukemias, because acute myeloid leukemias are much more common in the elderly. But
ALL, yes. Yeah. And I know there are differences in Philadelphia positive versus negative, but can you speak at all to that?
Sure. So, what I mean, in some ways, I think it's still a bit of a mystery. But the first thing is that childhood leukemias, you know, there is a little bump early in life, and that has always been a mystery, because if it was simply accumulation of mutations, obviously the same cells in a 5-year-old have more mutations than in a 15-year-old have more mutations than a 1 to 3-year-old, and yet that's where that peak is. And so we modeled it with our computational model, and we actually weren't even trying to get this, but it came up and the model showed us that it was drift. And so when we're born, we have relatively small populations of stem cells. And so chance itself plays a role, meaning you get chance distribution of alleles. And we showed that you could basically get an expansion of an oncogenic clone independent of its fitness effect, and that just increased the odds of the next event. But I should also mention there's really beautiful theorizing done by Mel Greaves in England. And he's also shown that another component of this is probably infections, and it kind of ties into the hygiene hypothesis. And then what he's arguing is that because children in developed countries are not exposed to so many, you know, pathogens and antigens early in life, that basically suddenly they go to school, let's say at about age 3, where this peak is really maximal, and they're suddenly exposed to things, and then inflammation kicks in. And that can have that promoting role. So in some ways, if you even look in the developing world, childhood leukemia rates are dramatically lower. It can be 5 to 10-fold lower. And so it's sort of a trade-off that in our modern society, by not exposing ourselves to these stimuli early on, we end up with a sort of hyper response a little later on that can drive these cancers. So that's probably the reason we get less lymphoid leukemias late in life, or certainly less acute lymphoid ones. Maybe just changes in the populations. I mean, we're not making as many T cells. We're not, you know. So it may just be sort of the number of susceptible cells that could be targeted has been reduced.
Mm-hmm. Bob?
I thought Jeff was going to go somewhere else with his question. In your final slides, you talked about the possibility that inhibitors of BCL2 or BCLW might eliminate senescent cells. Do you think there could be an immunologic approach? Do you think these cells would be recognized immunologically? Okay.
Yes. So one of the things... Let me backtrack a little bit. We now know that there are different inducers of senescence cause different phenotypes, overlapping but distinct phenotypes. The phenotype that results from genotoxic stress, so chemotherapies, but also a lot of endogenous aging is probably caused by DNA damage and DNA failures and DNA repair. Those cells tend to express on their surface ligands for natural killer cells. And it's clear that natural killer cells can and do identify those types of senescent cells, and they can also kill them. There is always, though, a resistant population, a population of senescent cells that no matter how many natural killer cells you pour, this is all mostly done in culture, the cells resist killing. And it turns out that those senescent cells produce very high levels of metalloproteinases, which cleave both the NKG2 receptors from the natural killer cells as well as the ligands on their own surface. And that actually is a double whammy, because it not only now makes that cell a poor target for killing by natural killer cells, but it creates a cage of decoy molecules that then will protect other senescent cells from killing. So we're thinking about maybe using natural killer cells as promoters of cell death, but then coupling that with, say, short-term doses with metalloproteinase inhibitors to improve the ability of the immune system to kill those cells. And then our lab and several other labs are now doing mass spec on the surface of different types of senescent cells to try to see if we can get a T-cell response that would help identify and kill them. So it's possible, but not much success right now.
So we could have a bigger market than immuno-oncology where we have
immuno-aging. Oh, yeah, immune aging, immunological modulation of aging, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Any other questions? This one in the back.
I'm wondering your thought on the cancer stem cells.
Oh, I can tell you right now, we've done experiments. We've done lots of experiments of exposing normal stem cells and cancer stem cells, sorted mostly from established cancer cell lines, and exposing them to the secretory phenotype of senescent cells, and the results are almost completely opposite. In the case of the normal stem cells, the secretory phenotype suppresses proliferation. Unfortunately, in the case of the cancer stem cells, it increases their ability to proliferate and also to migrate. And we know some of the factors, but we don't know all of the factors that are involved in that. Those two different phenotypes.
And I think that fits in with the sort of this idea that I presented, was that the cancer stem cells have basically, they've evolved within sort of an aged environment or a chemo-damaged environment or smoke-damaged environment. So they've evolved to basically thrive in the very same environment that the normal stem cells would be suppressed in. So it's that suppression of the normal stem cells that leads to strong selection for an adaptive phenotype. And so you end up with exactly what Judy just described.
Any more questions? So how long is it going to take for, you know, some of this, you know, early biology to be translated into some, you know, actionable therapies? You know, and it sounds like they have brought in, it's not just cancer, it's, you know, aging process in general. But, you know, from a cancer perspective, I mean, how long might it be to, you know, deliver one of these into the clinic?
Well, I can tell you right now, Unity is focusing on two degenerative diseases. Mm-hmm. They're not touching cancer. Mm-hmm. I'm hoping somebody out here will be interested in the cancer problem.
Uh-huh.
It's a harder problem in some ways, right?
Yeah.
It's almost the problem with prevention is that you have, I mean, I think you're going to have to start with a targeted population. I mean, like, there is prevention, for example, going on in lung cancer, but it's in the heavy smoker population. Right, because their odds are much greater. But if you were to sort of, the risk is now very great. If we treat a large number of people who just want to avoid, you know, some of the risk of aging, then you're treating a large population where any given, their odds of getting any given disease are on the low end. And so any potential risk is now going to be much greater. So I think we're going to have to target it to high-risk populations at least to start with.
Mm-hmm. And what is the profile of a high-risk patient group to go after first?
Heavy smokers, to me, would be the first population, particularly former smokers. And there are actually some nice trials where they've shown that it comes from University of Colorado. I had nothing to do with it, but where they use iloprost, basically the prostaglandin,
right.
And it dampens inflammation. And they showed that in former smokers, you could actually improve lung histology over time. Now, in the people that continued smoking, it didn't. Of course, they're continuing to wham their lungs. But I think that that's a great example of where modulating one of these parameters like inflammation could work. But I think that that could be an advisable thing for a targeted population. But I wouldn't suggest such a thing for the general population.
Okay.
For patients who take a low-dose cyclosporin, you know, chronically for autoimmune diseases, while they do have an elevated rate of cancer, do they, if they don't get cancer, do they live longer? In other words, does, you know, modest immunosuppression, is there anything, any evidence that those patients do better long-term or worse? I know, isn't it true they have a higher rate of cancer, I guess?
They do, yeah. Now, that I know. Yeah. I have no idea about the latter part of your question.
I think, at least my understanding is, it's an impossible experiment to do because these patients are sick. I mean, they're not going to have a normal lifespan anyway.
Right.
That's why they're on cyclosporin. And so it can't really be asked critically in people.
Does that mean Celebrex, for example, is used in some people as a chemo preventive?
Right.
Yeah.
And it's actually, I mean, it would be on the market today if Vioxx didn't run into that problem.
Yeah, but again, I mean, I think high-risk population, if you've got inflammatory bowel disease and you're at great risk for colon cancer, yeah, that's probably a good idea. But like aspirin for the general population, I think the side effects have been shown to make that not advisable.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, I think we're just about out of time. I really thank you, James and Judy. It's really interesting. I'm sure the discussion will continue over coffee. So.
Thank you.
Thank you.